Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files RPG podcast, talking bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. This is the second part to episode 16, where we've returned to Call of Cthulhu with our special guest, Mike Mason, the line editor for the game. It's not just an extra part, it's a fully kickstarted, brand spanking new edition. Since we released the first part, we've had the sad news that Carl T. Ford has died. He was the editor, publisher, and all-round engine behind Dagon Fanzine. In episode 14 of the podcast, at Daily Dwarf talked about how the zine produced great articles, supported the literature, published creepy mythos stories, and produced excellent scenarios for gaming and Lovecraft appreciation. In the previous part to this episode, Mike Mason credited the zine with generating a community of gamers around the game, which helped us get appreciation of why Call of Cthulhu was special. We have a lot to thank Carl for, so as a small token of appreciation, I'd like to dedicate this podcast to him. So, what have we got in store this time? Well, Mike Mason returns to face the Keeper's Screen. I will roll on a table, apparently at random, and pick some choice anecdotes from Mike's gaming history. They're not all Call of Cthulhu either. There's D&D and Almost Traveller. Daily Dwarf has written a piece about the scenarios that appeared in White Dwarf, and to remind us of how important the magazine was in helping us understand what it was all about. Judge Blythe, our rules lawyer, joins us to apply his assessment to the 7th edition rules. At the end, I have news about the dispatch of the zine to patron supporters and details of how you can be involved in the Grog Squad community. Without further ado, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Gainsmaster Screen.
Welcome to the Gainsmaster Screen, part of the podcast where I'll roll on a table and apparently at random generate 5 topics for discussion with our special guest, Mike Mason. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Dirk. How are you doing?
I'm great. Thanks for coming back. This isn't just a Gamesmaster Screen. This is an Emmy Award-winning 7th edition Call of Cthulhu Keeper Screen. What do you think of that?
Only the best for you.
Okay, from the list of random stories that you've provided, I've created a table and I'm going to roll on it to suggest a topic so that you can tell us more. Does that sound okay?
Sure.
Okay, here we go. And it's number 10, At Your Door.
Oh, okay. Well, At Your Door is an old Curzon Call of Cthulhu campaign set what was then the modern day, which I guess must have been the kind of mid-1990s. I really liked this campaign when it came out. It's a slightly strange campaign, and it's one that I think, you know, it's a bit chalk and cheese to many people. However, I have real strong memories of running the campaign for my home group. The campaign is all about this kind of the world kind of descending into madness and chaos. One of the kind of themes of the game is that the weather is changing. And that it's getting hot. I think if I'm right, it's getting hotter and hotter. And you advise as the keeper, as you're running it, to kind of just keep referencing that, to just say, you know, the weather's really warm today, and just building up that kind of general heat level as you go through the campaign. And the reason that kind of really sticks is that when I was running it, I can't remember exactly which year in the 1990s it was, but it was really hot, and we played it during this hot summer. And so we'd end up in the gaming room and just be absolutely stifled. And we'd end up going out outside and sitting on some garden table into the darkness, you know, running this game as the heat was starting to slowly dissipate in real life as we're running this game. And And that really conspired to kind of create this kind of mood and atmosphere within the game itself. It just kind of really gelled. And and of course, sitting outside as the sun's going down, still kind of hot because it's still pretty humid. And of course, you know, you get like, you know, birds and things rustling in the hedgerows, which was kind of perfect for, you know, when you're running the, I think it's the second or third scenario in the campaign, which is, I can't remember the name they give it in the, I think it's Landscapes, the one that's based on a T.E.D. Klein story. And that's set in some, you know, wilderness farm with some strange thing wandering around the farm. And of course, that just mirrored where we were completely in terms of like rustling hedgerows and darkness falling. So, yeah, it was so I've got quite strong memories of that and having a lot of fun with it. Yeah.
When I hear stories of Call of Cthulhu in the 90s, there seems to be lots of sensory tricks to create atmosphere in games. It seems almost like LARPing almost.
I guess to some degree that that's true. I mean,
blindfolding people, putting ice cubes down people's necks, things like that.
Oh yeah, yeah, we're guilty of some of that, particularly at conventions. And I guess it's that kind of strange thing. We were always role players. We were never LARPers at the time. That was a whole bunch of different thing that we weren't really into. However, we would steal some of their ideas, I think, grudgingly kind of accept that they did some really cool stuff. That kind of building atmosphere. I mean, yeah, certainly running the Call to Keepers, whilst the majority of games were, you know, pretty standard, sat around the table, there were a few kind of big event games we did, like Gatsby and the Great Race, where, you know, we were blindfolding people and moving them between different games and you know, randomly moving them around and making strange noises and whatnot. I remember a friend of mine saying that during one session he had a tin of squid and at an apt moment in the game poured it into a big bowl in front of all the players in the middle of the table and said, you know, and stick your hands in that. That's what I'm feeling at the moment. So...
You seem to enjoy the convention one-shots, like a keeper, travelling around, games mastering to strangers.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed the convention format in terms of running, particularly Call of Cthulhu, because I think, you know, Cthulhu is well known for being a great convention game because you can. It's great for a one-shot because of the nature of horror is that, you know, if everyone dies, that's all cool, you know, because it's a horror game. I enjoy, you know, playing with different people. You know, I've got my, you know, regular groups and playtest groups that I have these days. So going to a convention is you know, real chance to kind of meet and play with some new people who could be very experienced Call of Cthulhu players to people that have never played the game before. And so I always find that a really enjoyable experience.
Let's have a look back on the table and I'm going to roll again. Here we go. And here we've got, 99. So that's a fumble on our table. And that's Traveller Denied.
Yes. So this goes way back to the early days of my role-playing. So I started out in D&D and then naturally progressed to RuneQuest, because why wouldn't you? And of course, there was the Holy Trilogy, wasn't there? It was D&D. RuneQuest and Traveller. They were the three games. And yes, there was a few kind of, you know, pretenders coming out, you know, at the time, but they were the three core games. And you know, you were obliged to really give them all a try, I always thought. So I'd done the first two, and so I was really keen on playing Traveller in that first edition box, you know, the old Beowulf free trailer calling was really, you know, really gripped my imagination and, oh, I've got to play this. The only person I knew that had Traveller was this guy. I think his name was Bruce in the year above me at school. And Bruce, you know, was a big role player, and he came to the role playing club in school. And then one day, I saw him getting, you know, getting the traveller books out at the beginning of the session, thinking, oh, this is my chance, you know, this is it. And he and this couple of other guys were sat there, you know, starting to get ready to play. And I went over and said, oh, could I join the game? Yeah, I'd really like to give Traveller a go. And Bruce just turned to me with this stone face saying, no, it was for older boys. Completely denied. And like, just went away completely crestfallen. It's like, well, sod you. So, I wasn't allowed to play Traveller. So it was another year, I think, at least before I actually got to play. And I think I ended up buying it myself by then and running it for the group. But
was it worth the wait?
Hand on heart, I'm not sure it was, but I did enjoy it. I mean, I did enjoy it, but it was one of those games, unlike the others I played, it just didn't really stick. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it was. I'm not a. I guess the whole kind of like working out jump speeds and all that.
Oh yeah.
Just didn't really fire my engine. That was all dull to me. I wanted to kind of land on the alien planet and find some ruins and then there'd be some sort of alien horror eating us. Which again just goes back to that I like playing horror games. So and so the kind of harder science fiction.
Vectors are not that scary, are they?
Exactly. Just didn't it kind of just took that all out.
Okay, well, let's have a look at the next one. And the next one is 77. It's Laserburn.
Ah, well, Laserburn. This is an oldie but a goodie. Laserburn is a set of wargaming science fiction rules written by Brian Ansell in about 1980, I think. So it's a real forerunner of Warhammer 40K because, I mean, it featured things like, you know, dreadnought armor and bolt guns and whatnot. So, I mean, as far as I can see, there is a kind of a direct kind of path between that and 40K. And anyway, I mean, I didn't know anything about it, but I by this time I lived in Loughborough in the Midlands, and there was a miniature shop in Loughborough called Skytrex. It was right, you know, not in town. It was like on the outskirts, hidden away, and you only kind of knew about it if you knew about it. So we'd go down there, and Skytrex, basically what they did, they were a mail order business of producing historical miniatures in all sorts of forms, but all mainly really, really tiny. Some of them like 5 mil high because they were just blobs of metal as far as I could see. But what they carried was a load of like this old kind of really kind of old school, kind of chapbook kind of rules for all different sorts of wargaming. And of course, most of that was just not really of interest to me, kind of Napoleonics and all that kind of stuff, you know, not really my scene. So I'd look around these things and occasionally I'd pick up maybe a sort of a World War II, you know, tank commander kind of game, read it and then just completely have no idea how you would actually play it. So the day I went in and there was this thing called Laserburn with like, you know, people with ray guns on the front and aliens were like, yes, this is it. And I think it cost me like, I don't know, a quid or 70p or something. And I got this home and I kind of thought I could make sense of the rules. It had this pullout, this kind of double page pullout, which was completely filled front and back with a million tables. You know, that kind of classic kind of wargaming thing, you know, roll on this table if, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But I kind of, in my head, fashioned a way that you know, how to play it. It also went with, it also used 15 millimeter sci-fi figures, which you could buy from Skytrex. So I bought a load of these, took it to school and started, you know, running it. And we just really got into it. You know, there was no story. It was just like, you know, here's a scene. You know, you're a bunch of police, you kind of Judge Dredd type police. You're a robot. You're these aliens. You're these mercenaries. And we just meet around a classroom kind of desk during lunch hours and just bash it out. And It's fantastic. We actually had loads of fun, but because it was these kind of like, I don't know, they were kind of modern desks at the time, which were just these kind of like Formica kind of top desks, that you could use a pencil and could write directly onto the desk and it would like work. So you could actually draw battlefields on the desk in pencil. And when there's a big crater explosion, you could draw that in pencil. And, you know, and so by the time we'd finished, we'd just desk covered in graffiti. And we'd think nothing of it. And we'd just go, oh, well, you know, it rubs off. But the dinner bell would go, and we'd just leave. So whoever came into that lesson afterwards would just find their desk like this pencil battlefield of nonsense. So, Laserburn is a real memory lane kind of thing, definitely. And I think you can still get it. I think they've I don't know who's selling it now, but I think you can actually still buy it, because mentioned it to an old colleague from Games Workshop one day a few years back, and then at Christmas he turned up with a copy of it for me as a Christmas present. So that was wonderful. Okay.
And of course, the thing is with Laserburn, it's got the Brian Ansell Nottingham connection, which is where you live. And in episode 14, we featured Ian Marsh, who famously refused to go to Nottingham. Can you give anything in its defence?
Well, it is. I live in Nottingham. So, Ian, I'm sure you had your reasons, but but Nottingham is a great place to live. It's certainly, not only is it central to the country and therefore accessible to, you know, getting around, is very easy. But it's a great place. I mean, obviously, I think at the time it wasn't necessarily the hobby hotspot. It may be today. But certainly today, you've not only got Games Workshop, you've got loads of other games companies, existing, Battlefront and Warlord Games, and to name just a couple. But it's a real kind of creative hub as well. You've got the Games Museum here, the Electronic Games Museum. And they have a big kind of gaming kind of event every year, which is kind of all computery stuff, but it's still gaming. It's a great place. You know, we've got two games cafes now. I suppose I should name check, really. Luderati and the Dice Cafe, which are both fantastic places to go and play a game. It's great. And we've got trams now, which is even better. So, Ian, you should come up and have a cup of coffee.
Well, you know, if this game thing doesn't work for you, perhaps you could work with the tourist board. Okay, next up, and it's a natural 20, so Dungeons & Dragons.
Oh, yeah, well, as I say, I think my first role-playing experience was playing D&D, and so D&D was a game I played for a long, long time. I mean, occasionally I still even do, but played that for a long time. And one of the memorable things I kind of remember was at school, as a kind of an offshoot to the club, and this all stemmed from Imagine magazine and Dragon, that I'd read in these things about these fable things called role play tournaments. That I had no idea what that meant, but it sounded really cool. And I thought, well, I'm going to run a role-playing tournament then. And I just decided, well, how do I do that? Okay, well, I'll write a scenario that no one's ever played, and I'll run that same scenario for different groups of people, and I'll award each person in the group points as I go through the game for doing cool things. And that was my, very... unscientific marking method. And so I got the word around that I was going to do this. And so I had, I don't know, three or four groups, I think, of people. I said, you've got to get a group together and I'll then run it for you. And so I ran it, these four or five groups. And, I was quite diligent in the first, the first few of trying to, give people a little, I'd have this little bit of paper with their names against it, and I'd put a little point. And for when, you know, when they did something good, like they killed the orcs and they got past a trap, so they got 2 points for that, and I did all that. And then I remember in the final game, I was just having so much fun. It was just a really fun play session, and the group were making me laugh a lot. But I just forgot the score, and I just thought, wait, they can win. So they won, and I don't think there was a prize. I don't think I'd even bothered to get a prize. I think I just go, oh yeah, you won. And that was it, really. But that was my first formative days of running a tournament, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, you said that you're selective in a game group, and you still play D&D?
I'm in a group that's been meeting for, probably 20 years, I guess, on and off. To be honest, we haven't played D&D in that group for a few years now. But certainly when 4th edition came out, one of the guys said he was going to run it. So we played a bit of 4th edition then. And also, I had a long stint of playing D&D while I was actually writing and editing The Whisperer magazine back in the late 90s. I lived down in Milton Keynes then and had a group of friends who were based in Northampton. And they ran a very long, long, long running serious D&D campaign that I was invited to join. And in fact, I actually inherited a character was told, you know, this is how the character acts. This is what they think of all the other players in the group. And I kind of had to, you know, follow their guidance, otherwise I wouldn't be allowed to, you know, continue. But, you know, played in that game for some years, actually, that one campaign that I kind of wonder if it's still probably even still going. I played a fair bit of D&D in the time, but I haven't played so much recently. And I haven't really given 5th edition a try yet. In fact, the last time I played D&D, and it technically isn't D&D, but it is really, is a friend has got the board games. Is it a Ravenloft one and a kind of an Underdark one or something? Yeah. And we played that. And as we were playing that, I just said, well, this is 4th edition D&D because it's clearly 4th edition D&D, just with cards and things. And we all went, yeah, it is exactly 4th edition D&D. And we all then agreed, this is exactly how you should play 4th edition D&D as a board game, because it just works much better that way, technically without the role-playing elements. And that's, you know, hopefully what 5th edition, I think, addressed is to bring back a little bit more of the role-play into the system. But that was the last time, which it was only a couple of months ago, actually.
Let me give this the final shake. A good shake. Here goes. And oh, it's critical. Masks of Nyarlathotep.
Ah, oh, well, now you're talking. So my one of my school friends' brother-in-law picked up Masks. We knew nothing about it other than we were invited to come and running this campaign, and from the opening moments of finding, you know, Jackson Elias, the reporter's body in his hotel room, we were completely hooked, and this you know became, you know, a long running campaign for us. I can't remember what character I played. I think it may have been to the annoyance of other players. My favourite character that I created at the time, called Joe the Lemon Drop Kid, which was this kind of Michael Caine looking kind of private detective, but it was American, who would always carry a packet of lemon drops and would be very cool about, you know, eating them at precise moments and offering them to NPCs, which is the great annoyance of all the other players who all decided they completely hated him, which obviously made me want to play him even more. We went through, but he unfortunately came to a very sticky end in the London chapter of the campaign, where he was actually captured by the cultists and did end up being chained to a rock in some garden out in the middle of nowhere, and being I think the word would be ravaged by some outer god, to much to the great amusement, I have to say, of the keeper and the rest of the players, who still to this day will remind me of that particular instance. But nevertheless, as all good players in masks will do at some point, created a new character to continue, and we got so the campaign started to come off the rails when my friend Winnie, his character, who was the book learning one, he was the guy that would just collect all the kind of the mysterious tomes that we found as we went through the campaign, and was the one who was reading them, and so he had all the he had the Necronomicon and Cult of the Ghouls and about 20 different mythos books all stacked there that he was carrying around with him around the world. And then one day he just said in the middle of the session, "So I'm gonna just leave with all the books.
Oh no.
And I'm gonna run off to the mountains where I'm gonna study them for the rest of my life." And we all looked kind of like askance at him. And the keeper said, "Okay, is that what you wanna do?" "Yeah, okay, well you've done that then." So he basically ran off near the end with all of the clues, all of the access to any spells, or any way of us actually kind of understanding what was going on, leaving us completely stranded. So that went down well. And then that led to us ending up on some boat and finding this glowing green rock, which we thought was like, "Oh, this has got to be really important. We'll steal the green glowing rock. And, that'll stop the cultists." And then about a session later, we all died of radiation poisoning because it was radioactive. And that thereby ended the campaign. But, yes, so quite a memorable kind of experience, really. It was good times.
Why do you feel the appeal of the campaign is so enduring?
I think it's two things. I think one, it was one of the first campaigns to really kind of get the notion of campaign play right, in that it had this. It had a really, really strong connections between the different kind of elements or scenarios within the campaign. That there was a clue path that you could follow that made logical sense. So I think that in one sense it was just constructed very well, and secondly. It was genuinely this kind of like world spanning, and it was very pulpy as well. It really captured your imagination as you were kind of going around and fighting these different kind of monsters and cults, and it had this kind of real significant kind of ending to it in a way, and it. Yeah, the way it was constructed allowed you to kind of choose your path through it. You weren't following this kind of train track through. You kind of had the semblance of choice into where you would go through the campaign. So I think, it was, because it was the first campaign to really kind of nail that right, it got a lot of play. And so the kind of word of mouth about it and reviews kind of, bigged it up. And so it kind of has always kind of been held up as a good campaign, and so I think that sort of fared it well in terms of it becoming considered a classic in that way. It's probably what it is. It's got some very memorable scenes, very memorable characters that really stand out, I guess, too.
We've said previously that the campaign was responsible for giving the game a shot in the arm, and in some way is responsible for the longevity of Call of Cthulhu, because it showed what was possible, what was what the game was capable of. Because normally we were playing very small, low-key games, but as you say, this was a world-spanning event, an epic in scale.
Yeah, I guess. Because Call of Cthulhu falls very much into two styles of play. It's very clearly a really good game for a one shot, that kind of horror film kind of style game. But what Masks did was to kind of illustrate that you can play an extended campaign with this. You can actually play a campaign where the sort of slow creep of horror, the sense of mystery and investigation is really to the fore. And I think, you know, I always say, you know, crime fiction in terms of a genre is I believe the most successful in terms of sales of any literary genre. You know, crime, you know, you only have to turn on TV to find that, you know, crime programs are pretty popular. So that kind of engagement with a mystery that Masks really presents in a very good way captures that imagination. So I think, you know, in some ways, I think you're not far wrong that that I think at the time, you know, it really kind of, you know, as you say, gave the game a shot in the arm and introduced a you know, whilst there had been, you know, at least one of the campaign produced for Call of Cthulhu before that, Masks was the first one, I think, to really nail it, to really kind of get it right and to offer that style of play to, you know, to people that I think captured that, captured people's imagination.
And at Necronomicon, you've announced that there's going to be a whole new 7th edition version about to be released in autumn 2017.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so about 8 months of work of effectively redeveloping Masks and updating it to the 7th edition Call of Cthulhu. It's kind of come to a close now for me. It's been an interesting experience because obviously what I did, I brought in some other authors to help me work on it because it's not just a big beast; it's a very complicated beast that requires quite a high degree of attention to detail because there are the number of links between the different chapters have got to work and they've got to be logical. So I brought in people with a good history of understanding both Call of Cthulhu and writing campaigns. So people like Lynn Hardy, Scott Dorwood and Paul Fricker. And again, because we're all on the same time, we could actually get a lot of communication and flow through going, you know, rapidly. So we were able to kind of have this kind of constant stream of communication, which I think was kind of essential with a campaign like Masks because it is so interconnected. So we'd have, you know, somebody who was a primary writer on a particular chapter who would become the expert on, you know, what was going on in that chapter. So when, you know, somebody else who was writing another chapter was needing to kind of refer to that chapter, we could just directly have a chat and sort it out basically and understand, well, this, I've got this clue that's going to feed into your chapter. Where should it go to? And likewise, you know, where once comes back. And the reason I'm saying that is because a lot of clues existed, but what we wanted to do was really tighten them up and make sure that they were clear for the keeper. So the idea was to not really change what was happening in Masks, but change the or support rather than change the keeper in running the campaign. So it was easier for them to do because it is a complicated campaign, a lot of NPCs. And so, you know, it was going through and basically building reinforcing that kind of the logic threads through the campaign and highlighting them for the keeper, whilst at the same time updating the scenarios a little bit, giving them a few little twists here and there to, you know, keep them fresh. Also addressing things like the gender balance in the campaign, because there's very, very few females in the campaign. It didn't really make a lot of sense. It was just, you know, there should be a better gender balance. So we adjusted some of the NPCs to address that gender balance just to make it a bit more realistic, to be honest. There were a few plot holes. There are a few things that are mentioned in the original text that kind of lead nowhere, that kind of just leave you asking, well, what happens there then? What is that going on there? So we filled in some of those potholes and elaborated on them to create kind of new locations and scenes that didn't change the campaign, but added added some further depth to it, I guess, is the way you would look at it. And the other, the one, I guess, the general complaint against masks over the years has always been that kind of, well, you all start off as good friends of this Jackson Elias. How do you become good friends? I mean, most of the time, 9 out of 10 times, it's actually not an issue at all. You just accept it as part of the your character's background, and then just move on. It's never really been a big problem, but obviously there's a desire for it. So I worked with Scott Dorwood on creating a new kind of prologue chapter to the campaign set in Peru, where you actually meet Jackson Elias for the first time, and hopefully by the end of that scenario. Well, one, hopefully you're not all dead. And secondly, you haven't shot Jackson Elias. And thirdly, hopefully by the end, if those two things haven't happened, you actually are friends, if not good friends. So it provides some kind of, you know, a little bit of backstory before the actual main campaign begins. So, yeah.
I hope Warren Bassat remains. Would you like to join me with a pipe?
Oh, no, he's definitely in there. He's... yes, yeah, I know. He's. I mean, what we tried to do. I don't think we really cut any characters. What we may have done is modified their name to be realistic. There's some cultural names that are actually nonsense in the original campaign, which, you know, is understandable. You know, the internet didn't exist, and you've got to use what you've got to use. But nowadays we can obviously, you know, hopefully improve and get the names, you know, culturally correct. So we've corrected a few names in that sense, or modified the names rather than corrected them. You know, whilst they may be a different name, they are the same character, if you see what I mean. So a bit of modification there.
Well, it sounds like a great, great project. So when can we expect it to be published?
Yeah, so it is all written. It's actually currently being proofread at the moment, and art has been commissioned, because obviously this is going to be a hardback, full colour. In fact, I've just saw the first batch of player handouts come in from one of our creatives, freelancers, Andrew Law, who I actually worked with back in the day on Dark Heresy, the 40k role-playing game. And Andy has done some fantastic stuff. He's doing some maps for us as well, but he's just sent in some of the handouts, and they are jaw-droppingly beautiful. You know, they're period handouts in full colour. And I just saw the famous, you know, matchbook of the Stumbling Tiger Bar. He's done the handout that, you know, you've got the matchbook there drawn, but he's also... you know, it's also a diagram for how you cut it out and make it into a matchbox and that kind of stuff, which is just wonderful. So that's all coming together. Sorry, I'm going the long way around the houses to say that's all in process at the moment. We've obviously got to lay it out and do some final checking and things like that, but our aim is to try and get the PDF of it out before Christmas. So that's hopefully, you know, late November, all being well. But, you know, all being well, the PDF should be out before Christmas. And then once the PDF is out, we wait 2 or 3 weeks to just see if we've missed any typos or whatever, get those corrected, and then get it off to print. And the print process is normally 3 to 4 months. So sometime around March, April, all being well next year, the print version should be available.
I hope it's not too late to persuade Rick Mintz to do it in a box.
We had a big conversation about boxes and hardbacks and things like that. And I don't think it's going to be in a box because there's various reasons why it doesn't really make sense to do that. But
I know there's all reasons, but it's just better.
Yeah. However, the format we're now thinking of, I don't think you're going to be disappointed, because, you know, whilst it's not a box, hopefully there's going to be a bit of a box-like thing going on around it to some degree. I say box, more slipcase. but if all goes well, it should be very gorgeous, a gorgeous product that hopefully will, you know, just like the very first one did, hopefully continue to inspire and create great gaming experiences, you know, for the next 30 years as well, all being well.
Well, thank you very much for joining us on the Grognard Files, Mike. It's been great having you.
No worries, thank you.
And I'll pass on your details to Ian Marsh.
Dearly dwarf!
The two figures pause briefly before the vast Cyclopean entrance, then hauled the accursed portal open. Released from long eons entombed, the fetid air swirled about the pair, assaulting their senses like the exhalation from the charnel pit of some forgotten hell. Undaunted, the two figures entered the crypt, swallowed by the eldritch blackness within. As their eyes slowly adjusted to the Stygian gloom, they beheld an immense altar of vast antiquity, hewn in a time when humanity quailed in the darkness, and monumental beings of cruel intent bestrode the earth. Unknowable, tenebrous forms were carved into the altar's bas relief, defying comprehension. One of the companions stepped forward and slowly traced his fingers over the benighted atrocity, finding patterns in the hideous, indescribable contortions of the stone to reveal loathsome blasphemies that man was never meant to know. He cast a questioning glance back to his colleague.
Here, Blithe, do you think this Shoggoth is holding an obnob?
Yes, the Grognard Files is back in Lovecraft country, this time on a magical mystery tour through White Dwarf scenarios for Call of Cthulhu. It's interesting that, although the game was released in 1981, it wasn't until June 83 and issue 42 that the first article for Call of Cthulhu appeared, written by Marcus Rowland, who else, and titled Cthulhu Now. It looked at translating the game into the modern day. That's the modern day of the 1980s, of course, with a knowledge of PET Basic and an ability to extract data from CFAX and Prestel could be used to take down the great old ones. Why the delay? Well, I think it took the article and scenario writers a little while to get to grips with this tentacle beast, for Call of Cthulhu is a very different kind of role-playing game from what had gone before. This was not an exercise in hack and slash or the accumulation of power and wealth. Combat had been de-emphasised, with investigation as the character's primary motivation. Uncovering a trail of clues that linked to what appeared in a relatively minor event, and following that trail down darker paths to reveal an ultimate cosmic horror, was a very different template for a game. Oh, I know that some traveller scenarios involved an element of investigation too, but they inevitably ended with the production of weaponry and a final shootout. Characters weren't expected to hang around a week after week from one scenario to another. The defining mechanic of the game, sanity, resulted in the PCs deteriorating as the game progressed, spiralling down into madness and death. So, with this new gaming paradigm to understand, it's not surprising that articles and scenarios took a little while longer to appear in the pages of White Dwarf. Marcus Rowland followed up his initial article with some scenario outlines in the next issue, but it wasn't until issue 50, in early 84, that we got the first Call of Cthulhu scenario proper, The Watchers of Warberswick. But after that, scenarios appeared regularly, with a number of writers taking the ideas of the game and really running with them in a new and innovative directions. The new theme of investigation into horror was always to the fore, but against that backdrop, Cthulhu scenario writers came up with a wide variety of different settings, while mixing humour, twists, red herrings and pulp action to freshen up that theme and keep the players guessing. That's not to say that there aren't some issues. Dirk and Blithe spoke in the last part of this episode about the conflict in Call of Cthulhu between the player character's helplessness in the face of unspeakable horrors and player agency, where no matter how awful the cosmic vistas the players are confronted with, they still want to do something. that conflict between what you might call a purist Lovecraftian approach to the game and a more pulp direction is present, and sometimes in the same scenario, highlighting the unevenness of tone that Dirk identified can unbalance a game. There's another conflict in some of the scenarios when it comes to player agency though, and it's the conflict that can lurk at the heart of an investigative scenario. How do you give players genuine freedom of choice while at the same time peeling away the layers of the onion skin to reveal the single conclusion to the mystery? Can a game of Call of Cthulhu be run in a sandbox? Or does the resolution of the mystery inevitably lead to a certain amount of railroading? As we'll see, some White Dwarf scenarios handled this better than others. In discussing these scenarios, I'll try and avoid spoilers where possible. The statute of limitations for spoilers on 30-year-old scenarios must have long since expired, but it's just possible that you may still want to play through some of these adventures. Indeed, the beauty of these Call of Cthulhu scenarios, with their emphasis on story and investigation above reliance on large blocks of stats, means that they're easily adapted to more recent editions of the game, and even to other Cthulhu role-playing games. So, sharpen up your library use skills and grab an Elder Sign as we take a look through a number of Cthulhoid highlights from the pages of White Dwarf. We'll start with the aforementioned The Watchers of Warbler's Wick by John Sutherland. The name might sound like a ropey old episode of Doctor Who, but don't let that put you off. It's a solid and engaging scenario, perhaps fittingly for the first full-length Call of Cthulhu scenario to appear in White Dwarf. It has a classic Lovecraftian setup. The PCs are a group of 1920s academics, charged with heading into an isolated seaside community to investigate a mysterious bone in a local museum. With the benefit of 30-odd years of gaming hindsight, you don't exactly need to be Sherlock Holmes to guess the nature of the threat that the PCs face. But when it was released, it seemed very novel and strange. There's not much emphasis on combat, and the PCs have a reasonably free rein to explore the coastal town and piece together what has been happening. The only real criticism that I have is that the threat, such as it is rather remote. If the PCs do nothing, the threat might just go away of its own accord. That issue is easily remedied, though. When I ran this in the past, I had a relative as one of the PCs kidnapped. The party then had no choice but to actively pursue the mystery to its conclusion, whether the creatures wanted to be left alone or not. One oddity. The scenario is accompanied by an illustration of a lizard man by Ian McCaig. It's a great picture, but well, there's one problem. There's no lizard men in the scenario. If John Sutherland's first scenario is very much of the Lovecraft tradition, his second, The Last Log, with Steve Williams and Tim Hall from issue 56, really showed the versatility of the Call of Cthulhu system. This is the mythos in the far future. Having said that, the echoes from the 1980s are deafening. The PCs are the crew of SS Thatcher, a space freighter for a mining company. Ha ha, take that, Maggie. And in their investigation of an abandoned ship, there's a strong influence from the film Alien. Interestingly, I also saw parallels from the follow-up Aliens, but then I realised that this was published in 1984, 2 years before the release of that film. Was James Cameron a White Dwarf reader, I wonder? Anyway, the single location is illustrated with a diorama photograph rather than a map, making me wonder whether this scenario had its origins in a convention game. This is reinforced by the relatively light focus on investigation. Instead, an escalating stream of events is thrown at the PCs, demanding that they react. A lone survivor of the original ship, some homeworld rebels, and, of course, a mythos nasty, are all added into the mix. There's some nice touches of White Dwarf-related humour too. The pilot of the original ship is one Marsh Gascoigne, fate unknown, never to be seen or heard of again. And some strangely incongruous details. Despite this being the 23rd century, the captain of the original expedition, recorded his log handwritten in a notebook. Despite one or two confusing details, one PC is supposed to be suffering from acute paranoia. How the game's master is supposed to link that into the events is never explained. It's an enjoyable scenario with a novel setup and would work very well as a convention game. In issue 66, Andy Bradbury took inspiration not from Lovecraft, but from William Hope Hodgson and his occult detective Carnacki, the Ghost Finder, with the scenario The Horse of the Invisible, based on the tale of the same name. The player characters are investigating hauntings of an equine variety in a lonely manor house, and in a nice twist from the norm, they are encouraged to be sceptical and to seek rational explanations for the events that they witness. However, for me, this scenario is a little too scripted. Despite the PCs having links to one of the NPC's protagonists and witnessing various ghostly manifestations, there's not really much for them to actually do. There's a danger that the scenario just happens around them, with the PCs just as passive observers. Maybe that's a result of trying to base the scenario a little too closely on the Hodgson story. I like the setting, and there's some effective scenes peppering the scenario, so there's good adventure in here, fighting to get out. I just feel that some work is needed to improve that all-important element of player agency. Andy Bradbury was at it again in issue 75, giving us the scenario Heart of the Dark. In rereading the Call of Cthulhu scenarios in preparation for this piece, I think Heart of the Dark differed the most from how I remembered it. My recollection of it was as a dark, brooding mystery suffused with the spirit of The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. On rereading it, though, I now wonder if Andy Bradbury's tongue was very firmly in his cheek when penning the adventure. It has something of throwing the kitchen sink feel to it, as every Lovecraftian horror trope he can think of is included. We have the streets of Harkham, a mysterious count in an isolated castle deep in the Carpathians, a butler straight out of the Addams family, the Illuminati, a big bad from the Cthulhu mythos, and an odd little bit of gun porn, if that's your thing. As Andy Bradbury says in his introduction, it's a veritable school of red herrings looking for someone to hoodwink. Some of the clues that lead the players from one location to another are a little tenuous. Even if your job was an investigator, would you really jump into a transatlantic steamer to America based solely on the maker's label in a dead man's jacket? And one or two nudges from the keeper are required to keep the PCs to get the most out of the scenario. As long as players buy into the mood and style of the adventure, though, this could be tremendous fun, particularly if using the new Pulp Cthulhu rules. It's also a nice touch that it features three different endings of increasing mythositude, if that's a word. Great fun. He's been mentioned once already, but we can't talk of Call of Cthulhu scenarios without discussing White Dwarf scenario writer extraordinaire Marcus L. Rowland. He wrote five adventures for the game in all, using an impressive variety of settings and tone. In brief, we had Draw the Blinds of Yesterday, with a modern-day setting and an in media res opening. The players have to account for a missing time in their lives, following a mysterious lady with Jedi powers in an adventure that deftly mixes Cthulhu mythos with Greek legend. The Surrey Enigma, another in media res introduction, albeit of a gentler kind, this being an adventure of a 1920s vintage. The tone of this scenario is a little uneven. It evokes Lovecraftian idea of fragments of mythos knowledge slowly being pieced together to reveal a cosmic horror, while at the same time featuring more pulpy elements. Bitey, jumping skulls, anyone? The ending is low-key, although it can be used as a staging point for something more significant. Fear of Flying, an enjoyable scenario, an interlude for when the PCs are redlining across the map. It's Rumble at the Tin Inn in the sky, with an added mythos threat. Good Indiana Jones-style pulp fun. The Paddington Horror. A rescue mission for a missing PC. This is a very stripped-down investigation, and all the better for it. Most of the options for the party lead into a downbeat ending. And, of course, in issue 86, Marcus Rowland gave us Curse of the Bone, the winner of the 2015 White Dwarf Scenario Slam. See the Daily Dwarf's very infrequently updated blog for details. Set in modern-day Britain, it brings the Cthulhu mythos to the seedy streets of London, with the used car lots and crumbling sewers. I think this change of scene accounts for its enduring popularity, particularly with British gamers. It does feature one or two cases of the investigators having to make successful library use role to get a clue that progresses the adventure. Taken at face value, what are they supposed to do if they fail? Hang around till Ken Haidt writes Trail of Cthulhu, presumably. And then the trail of clues is fairly linear, albeit with some amusing blind alleys. But the grimy urban setting, ably illustrated by Martin McKenna, is very effective and brings to mind the mythos tales of Ramsay Campbell. When it comes to ambition, few scenarios can match Graham Staplehurst's Ancient and Modern from issues 80 to 81. Inspired by the writings of Brian Lumley, the adventure features two sets of characters, one in the Hyborian-influenced ancient setting of Thimdra, to be used using AD&D, and the other in the modern-day setting, well, 1920s, to be run using Call of Cthulhu. As Graham Staplehurst says in his introduction, for the GM, the scenario gets fairly complicated. The initial section in ancient times is very well written, with a magical battle between demonic forces and the last remaining good wizard. But it's a bit too scripted and exposition heavy, with the danger that the party just has to stand around and observe the machinations of these great powerful sorcerers. Much better is the section in the modern times, a classic Cthulhu setup, where the PCs must interrupt a cult's summoning ritual in a secluded chateau. There are many more options for the players here, many different approaches they can take, but there is a chance that the entire space-time continuum can be destroyed. And that's just in part one. In part two, the parties switch time streams and each must then quest to return themselves to their proper time. Graham Staplehurst sets himself the interesting exercise of translating staples from one game, e.g. a wyvern in ancient times and a shotgun-wielding farmer in modern, into the stats for the other system. And he largely succeeds, making for some novel encounters along the way. However, the powerful wizard continues to dominate the narrative in ancient times and the players remain largely spectators to the plot. It's also difficult to know how to play the ancient characters in modern times situation. Players' knowledge can all too easily influence that of the characters, and I think that this could descend into a fish-out-of-water laughs, which isn't really fitting with the rest of the scenario. But putting these gripes aside, this is a scenario epic in scope, with a lot to recommend it to a resourceful and enthusiastic games master. The final stop on our tour is my favourite Call of Cthulhu scenario from White Dwarf, Ghost, Jackal, Kill by Graham Davis in issue 79. Set in 1920s San Francisco, it features a memorable, exotic cast of NPCs, including the actress Theda Bara, trying to resurrect her career in a gothic Egyptian romance, and Dashiell Hammett, fresh from the Pinkerton Detective Agency, now working as a private eye. And who knows, maybe he'll be inspired to write down these crazy stories someday. It's an intoxicating mixture into which is added a very powerful cult leader, a rediscovered mythos tome, a determined journalist, and the very brutal murder of an ex-stage magician. It uses the classic onion skin approach of uncovering clues that lead to further events and revelations, but pleasingly not in a linear fashion. The players can structure their investigations in many different ways, and it can take an either an aggressive or a softly approach to uncovering the mystery. What I find particularly clever is that at the outset of the adventure, the PCs can unwittingly summon a very nasty mythos creature, dooming the party from the very beginning. The rest of the scenario can then play out as a foreshadowing of the ultimate fate as it slowly approaches. Great stuff, and a classic downbeat Lovecraftian ending. In the unlikely event that any of the PCs do survive, this scenario can always be used as a prequel to the Games Workshop adventure, The Statue of the Sorcerer. With some fantastic illustrations from Dave Carson and Steve Begg, this really is the White Dwarf Call of Cthulhu scenario par excellence. Suddenly, the investigators recoiled in horror at the ominous shuffling sound of movement coming from within the altar. Unable to run or call out, they were helpless, their sanity blasted from their frail human psyches as they watched the door open from out of the altar and a figure emerge from the fearful dark. All right, lads, said you like me new shed.
Just Blythe, rules.
Welcome to the Room of Role-Playing Rambling. I'm joined by Judge Blythe. Hello, Blythe.
Hello, Dirk.
And this time we're going to speak about Call of Cthulhu, the 7th edition. I've got the beautiful objects in front of me here. Now, when we gave Mike Mason the chance to pitch this to Grognards, why should Grognards replace the copy, the loving copy that they've had for years and years, with this new edition?
Yes.
And he said, well, it's in colour and we've sorted out the grappling rules. I think I think he sold himself a bit short.
Well, I think KCM always did Grognards a favour with Call of Cthulhu because they produced a number of new editions that were all exactly the same rules. They virtually changed nothing in all those rules.
Yeah.
This is the only one that they've actually changed the rules significantly with, isn't it?
Yeah. And we'll look at this. Now, of course, you're a resident rules lawyer.
I am.
You're a judge.
Apparently so.
And in this game, of course, you can be a judge.
Well, that's just what you want to be, isn't it? In Cthulhu, a judge. A judge? You don't want to be a judge? I don't know. It's NPC territory, that, isn't it? Surely.
Of course, the judges are enemies of the people. And
yes. I certainly am.
In order to help that, in this game, they can have history, law, library use.
Law? Yeah. Is that a requirement for being a judge?
I think so.
Oh, no. God, it's going to be interesting to see why things have gone wrong for me.
They can listen, know their own language, persuade.
Did they get, like, 60% attack with a gavel? 1d4 plus 1 damage, gavel attack.
Psychology. And, of course, intimidate.
Oh, yeah.
They need intimidation.
Well, a man wearing a wig. It is intimidating, isn't it? I'll do the gavel.
Okay, so yeah, we're gonna look in some details at this. So it now comes in two books, the Investigator Handbook and the Keeper Rule Book.
I don't like that.
Why not?
Oh, you know. They do this thing, don't they? They split rule books up. I like the rules in one book. This is the game. There you go, that's the game.
I think it works. I think it works because, you know, as we said in the last one, this has got the potential to be an entry-level game. So what you follow is the pattern of the biggest entry-level game, which is Dungeons & Dragons. And you have a player's handbook and a Dungeon Master's Guide.
Yeah.
And that's what you've got, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's fair to say that in our experience of playing, you're more of an investigator, so we'll get more.
I am, that's true. And I think my perspectives do often come from being a player.
Yes.
Whereas your perspectives come from
being a keeper.
Because you often run it, yeah.
And I think there is that division. There are people who play and people who run it. Mm. And I think you do have a different perspective.
You do. I'm just looking at it from a tight-fisted point of view, that it means paying for $2, whereas before it was a lot cheaper because it was just one book, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Whereas now it's two.
And I think that's the thing that people have, after the first part of this, they've said, is it worth it? Is it worth the investment? Is it worth the significant outlay? And I suppose, for one thing, like Mike Mason said last time, if you're playing Cthulhu, then that's a good thing. Carry on doing it. Don't feel the need to change. But
they say that, but we all think when there's a new edition out, we all immediately think.
Yeah.
At first, what we do is we go through. That's what I do anyway. I go through the process of, it doesn't matter. I don't need the new edition. I'll just keep on playing. But eventually, it gets you, doesn't it?
It does.
I'll buy that eventually. I've not bought it yet, but I will end up buying it. There's no doubt about it.
And I think with the prospect of the new supplements that are coming out and new adventures that are coming out, the new campaign packs are going to be in this edition, you're going to think, well, in order to run that, I need to know it.
You do, and There are new things in it. I mean, there are new rules in it. There's new stuff, isn't there? New ways of doing things that ultimately people talk about, and then you feel like you're missing out a bit, you know.
But before we go into the rules, I think you've got to say that what these books have, and something that they do better than the previous editions is that the indexing is really good. It's easy to find something, because that's been
when we used to play. I had third edition, I think.
Yeah,
that was okay. And did you and Eddie have?
It was like a fifth edition,
sixth that really drove you both mad. I just remember you literally lost sanity, both of you, flicking through the rules when we were playing,
trying to find things.
Was I think third edition, which was. I might be wrong, second or third, which was just a lot easier.
Yeah, so as a keeper, it is easier to play with this. But the other thing is, the other advantage that it's had over the other edition is the aesthetic feeling of it. It looks fantastic. The illustrations of some of the monsters are great. Yeah.
And that is a factor, because, as we've discussed in the previous podcast, Call of Cthulhu's not my... I'd say it's not my favourite game, but it's not top of my list, is it? It's not in my top three, is it? It's fair to say. That's not that I dislike it, but it's not in my top three. But when you look through those rules, it does fire imagination a bit. And in some ways it's an interesting topic in itself, isn't it? Because it seems a little shallow to say a good rule book with good illustrations makes you feel that the game's better. But it does have that impact, doesn't it? It fires your imagination somewhat.
Yeah.
And I think the way it's written and the way it's put across, speaking as someone who's not, as I say, not a massive fan of Call of Cthulhu, it makes me feel more excited about it.
Yeah. And if that was the thing about the third edition, wasn't it? The third edition that Games Workshop produced had those colour plates in, and it was the colour plates that people remember because they were so evocative.
Yeah.
And some of the pictures in here are great. I mean, I'm looking at this one, like chapter 14, Monsters, Beasts and Alien Gods, and it's just so full of atmosphere. A guy with a torch with a strange wolf-like creature cowering above him.
And
that just instantly puts you in that place, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it does help as well. It does help because... one of the difficulties with Cthulhu is the difficulty of atmosphere as a games master, isn't it? Creating atmosphere. You know, a lot of it relies on that. And that's what can be difficult in terms of running it. So it does help. It does kind of fire your imagination.
And I think the third thing overall, just building on that, is the fact that if they do use the knowledge accumulated of being keepers, in this keepers rule book, it does use that knowledge that's been accumulated over 30 odd years to kind of build it in to help new keepers who want to create horror games of some of the tips and techniques.
Yeah.
It presents them as rules, but really that's what they are. They're kind of a, rather than a mechanic, they are tips, you know, a tool for
because the rule, I mean, we'll talk about the rules in a minute, but the rules haven't changed massively. They've they've improved and developed some bits in interesting ways, but the rules aren't massive. It is about that kind of guidance, isn't it, and tips and tricks and how to run things, which is important. It's important in Cthulhu because it's, and not just Cthulhu, I suppose horror role playing. You know, I would say horror role playing games are probably the hardest to run effectively.
They are, because although there's always that potential, like we were saying in our last part of this podcast, of them just descending into an adventure, you know, just like less horror, more of an adventure. I think as well,
it's like that the discussion we were having last time about character agency. Some people on Twitter were responding to the last podcast had said that having no agency is part of horror. So in horror movies, that sense of doom and sense of not being in control are important aspects of horror films. And I think that's a fair point. But it's difficult, isn't it, to balance that against giving players a sense of control, but also giving them a sense of doom. And it's a very finely balanced thing.
Yeah.
That if you go too much one way, players just feel doomed and lacking any agency. If you go the other way, they're throwing sticks of dynamite at everything and it turns into a dungeon. Yeah. So it's a very, very difficult thing to balance. And I think all that's really useful in the new edition, that they're focusing, rather than rules, the game system, because the game system's not, there's not that much to it really, is there? It's quite a simple game. They're focusing more on how to run it and how to create that kind of atmosphere that you need.
Yeah, so an example of that would be foreshadowing results. So
yes,
a big emphasis on
yeah.
you know why this dice roll that you're about to yeah. make is yeah. important yes. and the consequences
yeah.
of your failure. Mm-hmm. And that's something that you would do intuitively as a keeper, having accumulated the experience.
Yeah.
But it's good to see that written down. Good to see that.
Yeah. Yeah. If you've never done it before, you know. And even if you do it, it's a reminder, because you get into bad habits, don't you? Or you realise, no, you've not been doing that. You used to, but now you've stopped.
Yeah.
And it's just a reminder.
So let's have a look at the rules then, look in a bit more detail. And as normal, this format, you have to pick three of your favourite highlights.
Highlights, yes.
And what are
they? Of course, these are new rule highlights. So they're not called Cthulhu as such. It's the things that they've developed. I think the first one, the one that stands out the most for me, and again, I think this is a player's perspective. I think the rules I've picked is very much a player's perspective. is the luck rules in this edition. Two things. One, luck is a statistic on its own.
So it's like an individual attribute that you roll separately, isn't it?
Yes, which in previous editions it was power.
Yeah.
I always thought it was a little bit unfair, because what it did was puts too much emphasis on power. So power, you generate sanity from power and you generate luck. And I think we once said, I think it was one of Eddie's games, we said the only thing you need to worry about in Cthulhu is power, your power roll. If you roll a high power, you're going to be okay, because you're going to be able to hold it together enough to run away. You're not going to go mad. And you're lucky.
Yeah.
Having 12 hit points or 15 hit points or 16 hit points, or 18 hit points, it's kind of neither here nor there, is it?
Yeah.
If a Shantak grabs hold of you, you're dead anyway. It doesn't matter, does it? But if you've got high power, you can stay sane and lucky and run away.
Yeah.
But it was always that thing, it was too much on power, whereas now they've split it down. So power is for sanity, but luck, so you can be low power, high luck, or vice versa. And that does seem a little bit more even-handed, I think. But the aspect I really like about luck is that you can use luck to improve your chances with the dice rolls. So you can burn luck points to make sure you make a roll.
So this works a little differently than some of the other games that we've looked at recently. So when we've looked at new editions, so for example, Mithras, that has luck points.
Luck points, which allow you to roll things again.
Not
like that.
So you can use it to subtract from a dice roll so that you come underneath your target amount.
Yeah. So if you need a 50%, if you're 50% chance and you roll a 54, you could spend 4 luck points or burn four luck to lower the dice roll, couldn't you? That's the way it works.
Yeah. So your luck points out of 100 will start to diminish as you use these in certain situations. Yeah.
So luck's 3d6, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then times by 5 gives you 100.
Yeah.
A maximum of 100. You know, might be 65, 75, 45, whatever. But yeah, you burn the luck points. So they're like percentage points almost that you can reduce from a roll to make sure you achieve the roll. But of course, every time you do that, you're running out of luck. So you can have a character, I suppose, who dies because their luck runs out, which is quite funny. Yeah. It's kind of in keeping almost with that kind of horror genre, isn't it, of someone dying because their luck runs out.
Yeah.
But I like it because, again, player's perspective, it gives you a bit more of a chance. And I think it helps Games Masters as well because we've discussed this before, haven't we, and I'm sure we'll discuss it again, that problem of basic role-playing where spot hidden item, library use, those kind of skills where you want to make the roll and you just miss it. And even the Games Master wants you to make the roll. The Games Master wants you to do the spot hidden item in the cultist's office to find the secret drawer. But you all blow it. Whereas burning luck allows you to make the roll.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, it's difficult if you roll, you know, you need 50 and you roll 80. Yeah. It's obviously
a lot. I don't know about you, though, but that. I'm not sure that I would use my luck up looking for a book.
No, that's true.
I'd keep hold of it
until
I was hanging from a cliff with a shantai breathing down my neck.
That's true. But sometimes you might do, there's always that thing, you're absolutely right. If you're looking for a secret compartment in a desk, for example, and you roll 85 and you needed a 50 or less, you're not gonna do that. But you do, we've all been on the receiving end of those rolls where you roll 52.
Yeah.
Or a 53 or a 51, and you think, for 1 point luck, I can find it, I can do it. And in that sense, it's quite useful. It helps the flow of the game, I think, a little bit. Yeah. Can do.
Having said that, that is one of the most... I think you're right to pick this, because it is one of the most prominent rule changes, isn't it? Because essentially, if you're a grognard returning to this game... There will be most of it will be familiar to you.
Oh yeah, it's the same game really.
And some of the things that have been changed around the edges are almost like house rules that have been adopted and incorporated.
Yes.
In there, and it fits in with the idea that this is a accumulated wisdom over 30 years. I find it extraordinary that it's presented an optional rule when some of the other rules are. Presented like as mainstream as part of the core of the rules, and that bonus dice and penalty dice is put in there as one of the part of the core rule set. And where this works is a bit like advantage and disadvantage in D&D,
and
5th edition, where you can have an extra dice as the tens in a percentage.
Yeah.
So if you're
If you're
driving in a squally weather and the bad rain, you know, you're going to be at a disadvantage. So you're going to have to roll three dice. One is the units, one's the tens, two of the tens to the highest.
Has somebody told these people that this is basic role playing? So you're always at a disadvantage. I mean, we're going to come on to this, but you're always at a disadvantage, aren't you? You know, you spotted an item or you firing a gun's only 50%. Don't make it any more difficult. It's difficult enough as it is. What's wrong with these people? Hang on a minute. There's these terrible monsters that could kill you, drive you insane, and gobble you up in a single combat round. Do you know what? Should we make it more difficult for people? That's a stupid rule. Do you know what? I have to say, aren't all rules optional?
Yes.
Yeah, aren't they?
Yeah.
I always find that odd in a rule book where they say optional rules. They're all optional, aren't they?
Yeah. I think it's interesting that is that luck rule, which I think is a great addition to the rules. Yeah,
is presented as optional, so you're allowed to ignore that one if you want, but other things.
Yeah.
Yeah, making things more difficult for people. Sheesh, Cthulhu.
Boss.
Something wrong with it's masochistic role playing, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not hard enough, this game. Your character killed every session.
It,
it does give you a bonus as well. But,
well, yeah, I suppose.
But it being Cthulhu, I focused on the penalty.
You are, of course. Yeah.
Okay,
that says a lot about your game matching style, I think.
Okay, so that's luck. Okay, and next one, what have you got?
Well, it's a bit similar, actually, because it does, I think, just similar things. But you can now, you can push a roll, can't you?
Mm.
So there's a rule where you fail a roll. And I suppose it works for roles like that where burning luck isn't an option because you've missed it by such a degree that you wouldn't spend 30, 40 points luck. But you can choose to roll it again. But if you do, the consequences of failure are more dire consequences. And I think you have to explain to the Games Master why you can roll it again, don't you? It's quite a nice touch because it taps into those kind of more modern games where narratives play more of a role. So it will let you roll this again, but as a player, you have to explain why. Yeah. How come you can try this again? You know, what are the circumstances? Yeah. And as a games master, you're going to present them with a worse consequence if they fail.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
Which so an idea would be if you're looking for something, you might decide to spend longer doing it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And thereby you have a greater chance of alerting somebody.
Absolutely. Presence. Or you're trying to pick a lock quietly, but then you think, well, I'll throw caution to the wind and try and do it as quickly as I can or in a better way, but it's going to make noise, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It does work really well, and I think we need to explore this further because when we were doing Fungi with Eddie, it did feel a bit more like a re-roll, didn't it? We kind of defaulted into, can I push it? And yes, you can.
Yes, you can push it.
and I've thrown myself off my own thought there. But it seemed to just become like a re-roll mechanic.
Yeah, but it should have some kind of narrative element to it.
Consequence,
so, yeah, you can try and search the room, you know, and make the roll, but if you want to make the roll again, you're going to have to come up with some explanation, some narrative, or something in your character background as well. You know, it could be something like, you know, you've encountered this, you know, you're trying to climb a tree or something, and you fail. You could say, well, I used to climb trees like this all the time as a child, so I can roll it again. I've got a better chance. That kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Bringing more narrative in. Although, don't you think, and this is a controversial view now, I'm going to be controversial on the podcast, these rules that we've just talked about, they're almost accommodating the fact that they've realised that in basic role-playing, you can't do anything.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hard to make the rolls.
Yeah.
The game system is such that it's hard to make the rolls. So they're bringing in rules that make it easier to make the rules. But that says something about the game system, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Actually.
Yeah, you're saying it's controversial, but I think it's more...
Heresy.
Because... What I think
that's the best form of controversy. If you're going to be controversial, I think heresy is.
Because what I'm seeing in you, Judge Blythe, is a shift, a change.
I've changed, haven't I?
Over these past 2 years into this person who has some reluctance to play basic role playing.
I do have a degree of reluctance because I think this is even more heretical. Because I'm going to quote an American. But when you, I think you did a game online with some people, didn't you?
Yeah, RPG Academy.
RPG Academy. And one of the RPG Academy people said that they found RuneQuest frustrating because they spent the whole session being sort of not being able to do things, and not being able to make roles. And there is that problem, isn't there, with basic role-playing, that even, you know, you sometimes look at a basic role-playing character sheet, and you look at a skill that's 50%, and your instinct as someone who's familiar with basic role-playing, and we're very, very familiar with it, because we, back in the day, we played RuneQuest, Call of Cthulhu a lot. It was our primary role-playing system, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You would look at a score of 50 or 60% in something, and you would think, pretty good. That's pretty good, isn't it? But it's not, is it? Because half the time, you're failing. Half the time you're failing. And when you play a basic role-playing game, that system, you become painfully aware that you're failing. Hang on, I'm 50% spotted and I've not done it. hang on, now I'm 50% of this. I'm better than you. You're only 35%. I'm 50%. Oh, no, I've not done it again. Because you don't. And it's almost like those rules in New Cthulhu are actually acknowledging that. They're acknowledging it. Pushing a roll. Oh, just let him roll it again. You can't do it. Roll it again. Burn your luck. Seems to me. I don't know. Might be wrong. But there's an element of that, isn't there? That they are saying, and there's a suggestion.
But games evolve, don't they?
Yeah, they do. Evolve. They evolve. I'm not. And I like them. Don't be wrong. I like those rules. I think they're good. But they do. It does seem to me in the back of my mind, it's as if there's an acknowledgement that people are failing roles. So, you know, even if you're quite good at something with a percentage system, you're still failing the role. Yeah. So we've built something in to give you a bit of a chance. But that in turn suggests it's a very fail-heavy system, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Which we've experienced, haven't we? You know.
We have experienced, but to me that's part of the fun of the game.
It is, of course it's the fun of the game. It is the fun of the game, and of course when you miss a roll by 1%, there's an element of humour in that, isn't there? There is that thing, it's quite funny when you spend a whole session, you're 70% of something, you never make the roll. And it is funny, of course it is, but I still think it's an interesting development in basic role-playing that pushing rolls, burning luck are all built around giving you another crack at achieving the roll.
Yeah.
You know, it's not so much, not quite the same. It doesn't feel the same as saying giving you advantage in a role. It's basically saying you can modify the role or roll it again. But that's almost like we're giving you another chance because we're almost acknowledging that the first time you rolled it, you didn't have much of a chance anyway.
Yeah.
That's how it feels.
Next one.
Okay.
And you've got attribute distribution.
Well, it's not so much attributes, but it's...
Attribute distribution.
Skills. It's skills. Right. Skill points. Because in Cthulhu, you have a character background and you get points to distribute amongst your skills. And what they do in this one, and I think it's a really good development, and it's a very simple development, really. It's kind of glaringly obvious development, is... You calculate the points based on not just education. Because I think in the old system, it was education, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was
intelligence.
Education, intelligence.
Which always seemed a bit wrong, because if you picked, say, a criminal background, well, a criminal won't be well educated, but that doesn't mean they're not very good at what they do.
Yeah.
So now it works off different stats. So it might be, you know...
Yeah.
If you're an actor, for example, it might be charisma times 10 and intelligence times 10. It's other attributes feed into divvying up your skill points, which I think is a good thing, because it does a little bit like what the luck and power thing does. It seemed to me that there was a lot of emphasis on education.
Yeah.
And any kids who are listening, that's not a bad thing. Okay. Any younger listeners... Education is important.
Yeah.
But in Cthulhu, it was too important. That's my view. It was too important.
I'm schooled in the University of Life.
The University of Life, exactly. Yeah. But it did, it seemed too important, because some of the backgrounds, if you're a hobo, you picked hobo. Education's, you're not going to be well educated. Well, you might be, I don't know. A hobo.
Down on his luck.
I think
there's it's good to shout out for the whole character creation process.
Yeah.
It is made very easy.
Yeah.
And it's described very well in the rule book. And I particularly like how they illustrate the character sheet by having call-out boxes explaining what goes in each of the areas.
It's a much better kind of walkthrough of creating a character.
Because if you go to a convention, because we're going to do that tonight, aren't we? We're going to play a game with a group of people who don't know the game.
Yeah.
The first thing you do is give them a tour of the character sheet, and it does that really.
Yeah.
It does that really well.
It does do it well, and I tell you what else. I think it's a very good rule book, because we've commented on this before, that we've picked up some rule books, role playing game rule books, and we've learnt them and we've explored them. But we've commented to each other that if you didn't know anything about a role-playing game and you pick this up, you would not have a clue.
Yeah.
You would not stand a chance. I remember the most obvious example was RuneQuest 6, which is now Mithras, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you bought that, we got very excited about it. But I can remember saying to you, if you didn't know what a role-playing game was and you picked this thing up, you would think, what the hell's this? Is impenetrable. But I think what they do in Cthulhu, it's a good... Given that it's a particularly quirky game in some respects, it's not a natural RPG. You're not playing a wizard or a warrior or whatever, or space pirate. They do a very good job of explaining it to the uninitiated.
Yeah,
they do. In some respects. And that's quite an achievement now, I think.
And what they do as well is give you, I think, one of the best toolkits for creating a character very easily to fit in with the period detail.
Yeah.
I think it's hard to do sometimes. I think people either over labour it or it's not enough.
Yeah.
And what this one does is it gives you some idea of how to develop a backstory, and it gives you a set of tables and to understand what locations are important to the character, what people are important to the character, some of the experiences. It's like building up a replicant. You know, you can use in a little bit, plugging in bits of memory and items to create a 1920s investigator.
Yes.
And something it did, and I'm going to call back now to the Top Secret episode, where you said, with these modern games, the most difficult thing is to come up with a name. Well, they thought of that as well, because there's a table.
That's a table of names.
A table of names.
Of course, yeah.
So, you know, for males and females, and you can just pick from this list, and they're period-appropriate names to help you. So I think that's really good. I think the whole character creation.
And that's important, isn't it? Because, as you said earlier, running a horror game is difficult for a games master, for a keeper, to create atmosphere and those kind of things. But part of that atmosphere and part of that process relies on good players and good characters and fully fleshed out characters. It works better. Again, you're going back to a kind of, you know, traditional sword and sorcery role-playing game. Whilst character background is important, is to be encouraged, it doesn't matter as much, but the whole atmosphere of a horror game and that thing of the games master's creating an environment that's a bit threatening, that has jeopardy, that has a bit of mystery. And part of that is how your character will react to this. How would your character react to this thing? They're not necessarily... I'm going to hark back to D&D, but you know what I mean? It's not like they're going to just kick the door down, draw the sword and kill everything in the room. It's about them being a person in a stressful situation and how are they going to react. So character background is important, you know.
Yeah.
And they do a good job of that, I think, in those rules, of giving that sense of being able to flesh out a character that feels living and breathing in this environment.
And not just defined by numbers and an occupation, which is all you had to go at previously. So those are your favourite, and we've got a sense of stuff that you didn't like. It kind of continues that thing of distributing points. There's not enough points to distribute.
Well, I think that's the thing I still don't like about it, that whilst the way the points are generated is better. I mean, again, you can fix this, can't you? Yeah, any games master can fix it by just giving people more points or whatever. But the way it's done in the book, I don't think they're a bit stingy with the points.
Yeah.
So when you generate a character, again, they end up being not that good certain things. So in the character I generated Freddy's game, I decided to be a con man, wasn't he?
Yeah.
That he wasn't very good at conning people. It's that thing, he was 40% at it, at those kind of skills that involve conning people, acting and persuasion, and 40%, 45%. Because I didn't have enough points. Unless I was prepared to bung everything on one thing.
Yeah.
Which you want a broad spread, don't you?
Yeah.
It was just that sense that he was better than your character at conning people, but he still wasn't very good at it.
Yeah.
Your character would have been awful at at trying to con someone. But my con man was just...
marginally better.
Not that good at it. Yeah. But given that he was a con man, you start to think he should be good at it.
Yeah.
And particularly given that in Cthulhu, you might not last that long.
Yeah.
You're not going to get the experience rolls to get your character up to really high, decent levels of percentages. So I just think the points, is it's better the way they do it, but it's still a bit stingy.
Yeah. Well, I want to give a shout out for something that I like a lot about it. And I do think that, you know, looking on forums and listening to other podcasts and other stalwarts of the game talk about it, they're kind of a bit dismissive of this, but I think it is good. And that is to do with the your core attributes being multiplied by 5 at the start. So you still roll them the same. So you roll them on 3d6 and apply them to create a percentage. And the reason why I like that is that you end up with grades of percentage within that. So you can have critical success and then various levels of success. So what it allows you to do is to create different levels of difficulty very easily.
Yes.
So where previously I might tell you to give me your dexterity times 3.
Mm.
I don't need to do that now. I can say, well, you know, let's do it at a half value or a fifth value within there. And what that allows then is something a bit like the James Bond game, where you can have a pause rolls to have levels of success. So you're competing against another, so you're hiding or looking out.
Yeah.
But the level of success will determine how well you do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And how this is different from how it's presented in something like Mithras, RuneQuest 6, is that it's much more straightforward. It's explained in a much easier way and easier to apply from a keeper point of view. So I want to give a shout out for that, because I do think that is an innovation that you see now in a lot of percentage-based games.
Yeah.
And it goes back to that James Bond game, isn't it?
Yeah.
Which is an iteration of RuneQuest.
Yeah.
But I think it's adopted here really well.
Well, I like it. At first, I didn't think I would. The idea of times in your 3d6 times it by 5, and then 5 or 3, and just on its own, as a percentage rather than as 1 to 18, isn't it? Or 3 to 18. It's just treated as a percentage when it's on its own. But no, I agree with you, and it gives you as a games master something to kind of aim for in terms of deciding how difficult something should be. You've got the 3 numbers there that you can go, right, that's standard, that's difficult, that's really, really, really difficult, and I know what I'm aiming for, rather than plucking, because we all did this in RuneQuest, plucking things out of the air, like you said, dexterity times 2.
Yeah, yeah.
Dexterity times 3, dexterity times 4, you know. You always think, well, never very consistent, was it? Whereas at least now you've got the 3 target numbers where you can go, okay, I think it's going to fall into that bracket, so it's going to be that one. That's the one it's going to be.
Yeah. And it's not a massive... It's not a massive innovation, but again, it's the way that it's presented that I like.
Yeah.
I think it's very intuitive how it's presented. Yeah. And I think its application in games will be easier.
Yeah, I agree. And you say it's not a massive innovation, but it offers clarity, doesn't it? It offers a bit of clarity, and that sometimes they can be the best innovations in a game. Something that just gives you, as a games master and a player, a bit of clarity over what you're aiming for.
Yes.
And what you're giving people. As a games master, what you're giving people to aim for. And as a player, knowing what you're aiming for. That sometimes can be, you know, like a really useful thing.
So, how do we answer the question that's been posed to us? Should people go out and buy it? Or should they stick with their existing edition?
Oh... Well, you're going to go and buy it, aren't you? Go and buy it. You're going to buy it anyway. Even if we said don't buy it, they're going to buy it.
I would say... I would genuinely say, and I'm not somebody, as you know, I don't...
No, no.
I don't buy things...
Lightly.
Lightly. I'm not a collector.
No.
Neither of us are collectors.
No, we're not. No.
If we're going to get something, we're going to get it to use it.
Yeah.
And I think that this is your old familiar game.
Yeah.
Spruced up and given clarity.
Yeah.
But more than that, it's worth buying on its own just for the source material.
Yeah, I would say.
Because
that.
It's rich, it's full of atmosphere. And you pick up a page, which I often do, you start reading it, and then ideas start springing in your mind
and
a
that's,
keeper.
That's what you need, isn't it? That is one of the key things with a rule book, that you know, if it starts ideas firing off ideas, then that's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know. So I think it would enhance your game of Cthulhu, wouldn't it? New and improved. It's the same old Cthulhu, but new and improved.
Thanks, Blythe.
Okay.
And you're going to go off and intimidate someone, then?
I am, yeah.
There isn't another bit.
Huge thanks to Mike Mason for taking part and being our guest for this episode. In November 2017, we had our second Grog Meet, getting together with some of the Grog Squad in Manchester, UK, for a day of gaming. Check out the grognardfiles.com for some of the photographs I took on the day. It was great. The next goal of the Patreon campaign is to do a virtual Grog Meet to give players who can't make it to Manchester a chance to take part online. The podcast will always be free, and the Patreon campaign helps to support the running costs of the show, helps us source new material for content, and allows us to do other projects such as the Grogzine, which will be going out to our current backers in December and will be available for new backers on PDF before the end of the year. Thanks for the generosity and good wishes of all the members of the Grog Squad. There are a $1 level and a $3.50 level, but this time we've had new $5 backers, so I thought I'd give them a period name from the Investigator Handbook. Okay, first up, it's Multiverse Jumper, whoever he is, for when he hands up in the early 20th century, America. So let's have a look. And that's Clifford Lockhart. Clifford Lockhart. That's a fantastic pulp name. Thanks, Clifford. Mike Hobbs of the Meeples and Miniatures podcast has upped his stake, so he'll always be known as Herman Slaughter from now on. Thanks, Herman. Finally, James Shevlin has joined, and he is Barnabas Riffenberg. So thanks, James. I mean, Barnabas. Next time, in a break from the usual format, me and Blythe will be taking a look back over 2017 and doing a review of a momentous year in our role-playing lives. We'll also be awarding the Groggies, the sought-after awards of the Grognard Files. Until then, adios, amigos.